Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, they say war is hell, but soldiers often cherish the fierce loyalty they experience in battle. For too many, coming home is the hellish part. Author Sebastian Younger looked for an explanation for this cultural phenomenon and may have found it in his research into Native American history. Younger calls out our cultural myopia as a primary contributor to soldiers' suffering. His new book is Tribe. Sebastian Younger is the best-selling author of War and The Perfect Storm. His Afghan War documentary, Restrepo, was nominated for an Academy Award. Younger spoke with KUOW's Patricia Murphy at Town Hall Seattle on May 31st. In this excerpt, you'll hear the core of their talk. You can hear the full program, including questions and answers, on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Thank you to Bree Ripley for our recording.
Wow, great crowd. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you, Sebastian Younger, for coming and having this important conversation with us.
Yeah, it's an honor. Thank you.
Can I get my veterans to say hello in the audience? Fantastic. I'd like to start by talking about how in your book, Tribe, you examine the roots of tribalism in the United States and how almost immediately that went against so-called civilized society. There were complaints that people were running to stay with the natives, but nobody was running away to stay in our settlements on the East Coast. Did you learn about that, and what have we lost, or what remains of that today in the United States?
Yeah, I make the point at the beginning of my book that America is the only nation that's risen to be a global power that was formed right alongside a Stone Age culture, the Native American tribes of this continent. And that situation lasted for several hundred years, and that both sides had the option, because of their proximity, had the option of choosing to transfer over to the other side because it looked like a better deal. And as it turned out, surprisingly, Benjamin Franklin and other thinkers and writers at the time noted that the people in the settlements, Europeans, white people in the colonies, were constantly, not in large numbers, but continually absconding and running off to join the Indians. And that, as Franklin said, we don't have one example of an Indian, he called them, of joining our society. And that was actually a source of some consternation, because of course this was a society that thought very well of itself, right? It was an upright, developed, civilized Christian society, and the people in it just assumed it was the best thing going. And so it really, the fact of the matter that people kept leaving it and not going in the other direction actually flew in the face of what colonial society thought of itself. And some people, Thomas Paine and some others, took some stabs at trying to figure out what was it that was so appealing. And the answer they came up with, one missionary that I found said that the Native Americans lived their entire lives in liberty, from birth till death. The fundamental egalitarianism of Native society was thought to be an allure, and that it was basically a free and open society. They didn't have class structure. People were judged in their own merits. I mean, in a weird way, it was a kind of a utopia. And as a result, as Thomas Paine and others were assembling their ideas for the Constitution and for incorporating ideas of liberty into our founding documents, they used sections of what was called the Iroquois Great Law of Peace, and the inalienable rights of man, and these sort of ideals that were part of the Enlightenment thinking in Europe were also found incorporated into Iroquois society and were taken directly from Iroquois tradition and put into some of our founding documents. It's just an extraordinary sort of cross-pollination of societies at that point.
What can we learn from those tribalisms that we can try to apply to our society today? Where are we lacking, and really, how can we get back there?
Well, the egalitarianism of that society was very much rooted in the kind of economy that they had. I mean, people, it was an organic society. I mean, everyone was engaged in the sort of mechanism of survival. The communities were defended in a very immediate sense by their members. The Iroquois, in particular, had an interesting system where there were war leaders who took over when there was conflict, and as soon as the conflict stopped, all of their authority was abolished, and the authority was transferred to peacetime leaders. And during war, if the enemy negotiated for peace, the terms were considered by the peacetime leaders, not the war leaders. And so how do we, you know, as a modern society, how do we duplicate that? I don't think we can. I mean, you can't just sort of scale it up and have it all work the same way. And my book, Tribe, is about what happens. It's about that sort of ancient human preference for community, for human closeness in the way we live. And what are the costs of losing that and loss that we have? I mean, there's amazing, amazing benefits to being in modern society. I'm happy to list them, but I'm sure we all know them. But then the costs are really significant, and they are they're emotional, they're psychological. I found that as wealth goes up in a society, the suicide rate goes up. Depression rate goes up, and we can talk more about that later. But there are real costs to modernity. We evolved to live in groups of 40, 50 people. We're primates, right? I mean, we're a social species, and we did not evolve to live in an emotionally separate way from the people around us. And that's what's happened, and it has a real cost. The Amish, for example, they have a very low rate of depression, very low rate of suicide. They don't drive cars. And what that means is they are forced to live out their lives in close proximity to other people. And there's a real buffering effect to that when it comes to mental illness. And so, you know, I'm not suggesting this, but if you wanted to address the problem, I think you would almost have to ban the car. I mean, it would sort of force us to revert to a kind of communalism. Could we obtain some of those benefits and still drive around in our Prius? Hopefully. Human society has never done that before. But as I pointed out a few days ago to someone who was asking me a similar question, like, you know, in the late 60s, we'd never walked on the moon either. So if we can do that, we might be able to figure it out. But it's a new situation for humanity, this one that we're facing.
You talk a lot about the tribe-like mentality that occurs among soldiers when they're at war. And I wonder if that bond is necessary to complete the mission. And I also wonder whether or not it started in boot camp for a lot of people, whether it was designed to be that way.
Yeah, I mean, it started in boot camp. It started in the Stone Age. But, yeah, a platoon in combat very closely replicates our evolutionary past. And we evolved to live in groups of 30, 40, 50, 60 people, maybe tops 100, 150 maximum. Larger than that, you start to deplete the resources around you if you're a hunter-gatherer. And that means you intimately knew everyone that you lived with. And furthermore, and most importantly, that there was no individual survival outside of group survival. You could not on your own decide, well, the group's not that important to me. I'm going to do my own thing. And it meant that even in combat, self-sacrifice, like you might as well take enormous risks to defend the group because you're not going to survive without it anyway. And a platoon in combat functions very, very much that way. And I've never been through boot camp and I haven't covered it as a journalist, but my guess is that the drills and the training reinforce something that is already absolutely hardwired into our primate brains in terms of our commitment to the group, our commitment over sort of basically valuing the group over the individual. One guy that I was with in the platoon that I covered for off and on for a year in Afghanistan, he said to me, you know, it's funny, there's guys in the platoon who straight up hate each other, but we'd all die for each other. And, you know, I realized that's actually not a relationship that you can find in civilian life. Friends, good friends might die for each other. Family members might hate each other and still do that, like on a good day. But basically, people who don't like each other aren't going to sacrifice very much for each other in civilian life. In combat, you cannot think that way. And in our evolutionary past, there were surely vicious conflicts within these small groups. But if you didn't have this ethos of the group above all else, the group wouldn't survive. And I write about this in my book, War. One of the things that separates, and we're very, very closely related to chimpanzees. We share 98% of our DNA with chimpanzees. But one of the behaviors that, and chimpanzees use tools, there's child rearing, there's learning. I mean, there's all kinds of very human-like stuff in chimpanzee society. And it is a society. But the one thing that you do not see in chimpanzees, only in humans, that same-sex peers will rush to each other's aid if there's a mortal threat, even though there's almost a near certainty of dying. In chimpanzee society, if one male gets attacked by males of a rival chimpanzee troop, ganged up on and attacked and beaten to death, his buddies, the other males in his group, will not come to his aid. Even if that would mean evening the odds and it might be a fair fight, they run away. And that is absolutely not what humans do, and it really sets us apart in the animal world. It's a kind of altruistic bravery, almost suicidal bravery on behalf of others that you care about. It's extraordinary. I find it to be a very, very moving thing in human society.
It seems to make sense, bringing it back to humans, that once you would share that bond with a group, with a platoon, perhaps in a combat situation, maybe not even a combat situation, it is hard to let that go and to, even though you may be coming back to a supportive family, you're a different person coming back from that experience, a changed person.
Yeah, one of the impulses for this book was me trying to figure out why there was such a high rate of PTSD in the U.S. military. And that was something that interested me and personally concerned me because I'd spent a year with a platoon off and on and cared a lot about those guys. And I watched them struggle. The ones who struggled were the ones who got out of the military. The guys who stayed in were okay while they were in. And the people who got out, you sort of hit this buzzsaw when they came home. And I was an anthropologist in college. I did my field work on the Navajo Reservation. And I was a pretty good runner and a distance runner in college. And I wrote a thesis about Navajo long-distance running. I trained with their best guys. And it was an amazing experience. After that, I sort of looked at everything through this sort of anthropological lens. And that's how I do my journalism. And I had this idea. I was like, I bet, you know, I mean, the Navajo, the Apache, the Comanche, like, they were very warlike societies. And I was like, I bet those guys weren't getting PTSD. You know, like imagine the combat back then. I mean, you know, it wasn't sniper rifles at 400 meters, right? It was clubs and hatchets and spears. I mean, imagine just the trauma of engaging in that kind of combat. And I started to look into it, and I started talking to anthropologists who'd worked around the world. And indeed, it seemed to be true that the level, I mean, everyone reacts to trauma. Almost everyone has a traumatic reaction if they're traumatized. But it's usually transitory. It lasts some weeks, some months. I've had it as a journalist. Only about 20% of people get stuck in a kind of long-term trauma loop. In our society, it's much higher. And so what seems to happen is that if you return to a really close, cohesive society, like a tribal society, people recover from trauma quite quickly. And it makes sense. I mean, we evolved as a species to survive. It was a harsh environment that we evolved in. If trauma incapacitated us psychologically, we wouldn't be here as a species. I mean, it's taken 2 million years to get here. We would not have made it if getting attacked by a lion and almost killed incapacitated us. We wouldn't be here. And what seems to be the reason is that if you have the near miss with the lion and you return to a close cohesive society, you recover quite quickly. And the soldiers in this country, American soldiers, are coming back to a modern society that has enormously high rates of mental illness, and that to me is like the significant factor in the really high rates of PTSD that we have.
We don't have the block party mentality that we used to have. Like, even back in the 70s, right? We live in a very secular world. We have our iPhones. That cannot help, in some ways, bringing people back and looking at them like you're just another human anymore. In some ways, we don't look up enough.
Yeah, I mean, I looked at PTSD and just general disability rates for all of the nation's wars. And it's very odd. Every war, starting with the American Civil War, every war, the casualty rate and therefore the combat, the intensity of the combat, the casualty rate has gone down, thank God, every war. But the disability rate, the rate at which people claimed both physical and psychological disability from the government, has gone up. So as casualties are going down, combat intensity is going down, disability is going up. They should be going in the same direction. And, I know from World War II, the veterans came home. I mean, we all know what happened in World War II and how hard that was on everybody, on civilians in Europe, civilians in this country, and on soldiers, on veterans. And they came home, and they came home to a country that still needed them to work. And they were put to work when they got back, and they came back to very cohesive communities. I mean, a friend of mine, her father fought in World War II, and when he came home to Kenosha, Wisconsin, he lived within a few blocks of his 6 brothers who'd also fought. And the thing about a wealthy society, which broadly speaking we are relative to the rest of the world, is that as wealth goes up, you can make individual choices. So you can move, you can grow up in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and decide to move to California or move to New York or whatever. And the wealthier we get as a society, the more individualistic our choices are, which is great in so many ways. But it means that you do not have the kind of community support that you would have if you stayed where you grew up. And that has an enormous impact on our mental health. And I mean, there's the iPhone conversation we could have, which I think is just an extension of that alienation. It's not something I've studied, but I have plenty of opinions about it.
Flip phone.
I have a flip phone. There's my opinion about iPhones.
It also took a lot longer to get home from World War II. There was a decompression time that people had on their way back from World War II. In Afghanistan and Iraq, one minute you're in Afghanistan, and in 50 hours, you're still tapping the sand out of your boots, and you're back in the United States. There is very little time to make that adjustment.
Yeah, I think that transition time is really important. And keep in mind, this isn't just about trauma. In fact, it's primarily not about trauma, I think. I mean, Peace Corps volunteers are not traumatized, but they live in very cohesive, community-oriented places for a couple of years. You know, they're in a village in Cameroon or wherever for a couple of years, and when they come back, they have quite high rates of readjustment problems and depression. I mean, it's known in the Peace Corps that as hard as it is to go from New York City to living in a village in Cameroon, it's way harder to come back. And the U.S. military, I mean, a lot of civilians don't know this, but around 10% of the U.S. military is actively engaged in combat. The other 90% really may not be traumatized in any significant way during their deployment. And yet an enormous number of people who deploy come home and are deeply affected by the transition. They get depressed, they feel alienated, they feel like they don't belong. It's called PTSD. That's the word we all have for it. But in fact, if you weren't traumatized, it by definition cannot be PTSD. But what it can be is the kind of transition disorder that that Peace Corps volunteers have. And it is just as dangerous. It's just as deadly. It doesn't need to be PTSD to pose a threat to someone's psychological health or even their life. And there is a real risk of calling it the wrong thing. A lot of people, I know a lot of vets that I know, are really bewildered by their sense that they don't belong, they feel like they don't belong to this society. And, you know, I've started saying, you know, you're not alone. Like, a lot of people who didn't go to war feel the same way. And I really think it's a sort of societal problem. I had this idea that, okay, how do you sort of test for that, right? What happens if you take modern society and you collapse it? How do people react? Because if my theory's right, if you take modern society and you collapse it and force people to live communally, they should do better, right? Because they want to, we are wired to want to live communally. This is my theory, right? So I started looking at situations where a modern society had a catastrophe happen to it. One was the Blitz in London. And what happened in London? For 6 months, the German Air Force bombed London almost every night, killed 30,000 people. I mean, I live in New York City. On 9/11, we lost 3,000. And it completely traumatized the population of New York. 30,000 people died in London. People were living, sleeping shoulder to shoulder in the tube stations. They were forced into a communal society. And what happened afterwards? A lot of people in London missed the Blitz. The officials in London, the administration, was worried that there would be mass psychiatric casualties during the Blitz, along with the physical casualties, and they're prepared for literally millions of freaked out people checking themselves into psychiatric wards because the bombing was driving them to hysteria. And what happened was the opposite, that when the bombing started, admissions to psychiatric wards went down. As one official said, we have neurotics driving ambulances. When there's a crisis, you understand that your community needs you, your people need you, and it seems to buffer people against their psychological troubles. One woman I read about said, a civilian said, you know, during the Blitz, we would have all gone down to the beaches with broken bottles to fight the Germans if we'd had to. Now, when you have people who are that communalized, psychologically, they do very well. The first war that I was in Sarajevo in 1993. I was a young man, and I wanted to be a war reporter, and I packed a bag, put a sleeping bag in it, and some notebooks, and a pair of hiking boots, and a typewriter, actually, because I heard that literally a manual typewriter, because I heard there wasn't electricity in Sarajevo. And I went off to Sarajevo, and I covered that off and on for about 6 months, I think, yeah. And I mean, you know what happened there. I mean, the Bosnian Serb army surrounded that city and used the civilian population for target practice for 3 years. I mean, they killed or wounded one-fifth of the population of that city with artillery and sniper fire. Completely traumatized 350,000 people in that city, right? And the war finally ended, and the city got rebuilt, and I finally went back there last summer. It was amazing. It was a beautiful city. I mean, it was such a joy to see, you know? And I met with this woman named Nizara, who was a journalist, and she had been wounded at 17. She'd been wounded during the siege. A tank round had hit her parents' apartment and almost took her legs off, and the doctors were able to save her legs. They performed reconstructive surgery on her legs without anesthesia because there wasn't any. 17-year-old girl, right? So she survived. 20 years go by, 20-plus years, and I finally am back there last summer, and I met with her. She's a journalist, and she interviewed me, but I actually ended up interviewing her. And she said, you know, we were talking about this stuff, and she said she literally dropped her voice. We were at a cafe, and she literally dropped her voice. She said, you know, the war was terrible, but we all miss it. So we miss how close we were. We had to be close to survive. And war is so horrible, and if people miss it, it must mean that society really has problems for anyone to miss war. We were better people then. We were more generous. We cared for each other. And I'll just leave that story with this, that she said that there was some graffiti that she'd seen referring to the war, and the graffiti said this. It said, things were better when they were bad. Now think about those stories and think about veterans fighting in a platoon, in a little outpost, how close they would get. And now picture taking them and then dropping them down in the great American suburb. Like, what's going to happen to them? It's not hard to guess.
A lot of a successful transition for veterans begins with a new sense of purpose, with a comfortableness in your new skin, in your country again. We are always hearing about, we love veterans, we'll hire veterans, we'll do all this. Are we really helping veterans?
I think in some ways our society is failing all of us. Veterans are particularly vulnerable group, I think, and particularly strong. I mean, I think veterans are a strange mix of vulnerable and more vulnerable than many people, civilians, but also much, much stronger. My instinct is to say that maybe the most valuable thing the society could do for veterans is to make sure that they have the opportunity to work. One of the things that is very, very compelling about being in the military, I've heard, is that you feel that you're needed. You know, I mean, you have a very specific task and enormous responsibility for people you care about enormously, right? And that's how, you know, again, that's how we evolve to survive. I mean, that's what humans are. And soldiers are given that in spades in combat. And in support units, too. It's not just combat, it's both. An incredible sense of purpose and meaningfulness. And you're judged... You know, you're judged on your own merits, right? Like, if your father's like a college professor or not, or in jail or not, or what your personal, I mean, whatever, it doesn't, the personal details really don't matter. What seems to matter to soldiers is how you conduct yourself in the group, and if you are doing everything you can to make sure everyone gets home alive. That's how you're judged, right? So, that's something that everyone has control over, right? I mean, high school, the things you're judged for, whether you're good-looking or not, or what kind of family you're from, whatever, you don't have control over that, right? But you're in combat, you're totally self-defining. I mean, you could be 5'1", and if you're a good soldier, it doesn't matter that you think you're short, right? I mean, it's, you know, if you want to join the basketball team, you better be tall. There's nothing you can do about it. In combat, really what's selected for is grit and determination and dedication to the group, and everyone has access to those virtues. And so they come back from this self-defining environment to society where they start to be judged again for things they don't have control over. And I and And I think the most urgent thing we can probably do for veterans is make sure that they have a purpose, a utility, where they can demonstrate how fine they are, how effective they are. It's something that humans really need. I found an account of an earthquake in Italy, in Avezzano, Italy, in 1916, I think it was. And it, you know, killed something like 90% of the population. I mean, it was like a nuclear bomb had gone off. And the survivors, it took days for help to reach the survivors. And this one person who wrote an account of it said that rich people, poor people, there were no distinctions made between anybody. All this sort of class structure in Italian society disappeared. Everyone was just surviving, right? And he said that the earthquake had created what the law promises to deliver. The earthquake had created what the law promises, but in fact does not deliver, which is the equality of all men. And I think what the most important thing, not just for veterans and soldiers, but frankly for all of us, that there is a sense of equality that transcends, at least the potential for equality, that transcends the burdens that we're all born with, one way or another.
There are so many things about these wars that are unprecedented. Multiple deployments, people living where in previous wars they may have died, chronic pain, traumatic brain injuries. All of these things present themselves in our communities. How equipped, really, are civilians to look at this in a meaningful way? Do our politics get in the way? Are we interested in understanding in some ways? Because I think in this city of Seattle, it can be difficult sometimes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if we want to consider ourselves a country, a unified country, which we'd better, frankly, it means that we all own the decisions that the country makes and the actions the country takes, even if we disagree with them, but we own them. We have to think of it that way. You can be for the war, you can be against the war, but you do live in a country that went to war. It's not the soldiers' war. It's our war. And that's true for the most vehement pacifist and the most vehement patriot equally. And if you don't think of it that way, you will start to split the country up, which seems to be a danger right now, actually, for a variety of reasons. But it really comes down to thinking about ourselves, in a sense, kind of tribally, right? Like, we're together in this, and we're going to be disagreeing all the way down the line, right? Because we're a complicated, messy democracy, so there's going to be a lot of disagreement. But at the end of the day, we have collectively elected a government that has made certain decisions, and we own it. We own it. It's not the soldiers' problem. You can't. Sometimes people who were against the war, wars, will say to me, like, "Don't they realize like what they're doing?" About soldiers, right? Don't they realize what they're doing? And I'm like, "Look, you're asking 19-year-olds to hold a referendum on the nation's wars. The 19-year-olds are assuming that the adults in the room, the Congress and the president, made a responsible decision. You really can't ask the 19-year-olds to step in and second-guess the decision that our government made. That's not fair. It's a civilian, we have a civilian government. The government makes the decisions and the army follows orders. And you really can't blame the wars on the army. It's us and it's our tax dollars. And once you start thinking that way, you're in the uncomfortable position of being responsible for something you might have been against. But the advantage of it, and it's a very important advantage, it's crucial, is that we become one country again. And once we feel like we're one country, then we can start arguing about how to run it. But don't, like, we we can't start splitting off in that way and disavowing things that our country has done. It's still our responsibility, like all of us.
Shared risk, shared responsibility. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I love just a couple more questions, actually, yeah, before we let you guys talk. You had this really interesting idea, you were chatting about it in the green room, about an open mic for veterans, and you've done this in other cities. And this is something where you let veterans come up and speak for 10 minutes, and people just listen. And I wonder if that act is informative and can change minds, and that conversation is important, that we feel the uncomfortable truths of war in a personal way from fellow humans rather than reading it in the newspaper, from the people who are actually there.
Yeah, I mean, I got this idea from looking at Native American society, and in a society that is that sort of organic, everyone is very, very aware. And I'm going back into previous centuries now. Okay, not right now. I mean, obviously, situation on reservations right now is very complicated and often heartbreaking. But before the cultures clashed in the sort of origins of those societies, everyone was intimately acquainted with the things that kept everyone alive, right? So if you lived off buffalo meat, you understood how buffalo were hunted and how they were butchered and how it was cooked, and you know every aspect of the society that kept everyone alive was intimately familiar with that. In modern society, we're not, right? For some good reasons. We live in a huge, sprawling, complex society. And we live in wooden houses, and most of us don't know loggers, right? We work in high rises, and most of us don't know construction workers who build high rises. Like, I mean, it's just the reality of modern society. But there's a real downside to that, and this disconnect between the benefits of our lives, of our society, and the things that keep it going. There's a huge disconnect, and one point in my book, I talked about the phrase "no blood for oil," which I think was a sort of well-intentioned slogan against the Iraq War. Which, I mean, I was against the Iraq War myself, so I get it. I actually didn't think the Iraq War was about oil, but what struck me about that slogan is that it was a bumper sticker, right, that was put on cars that run on oil. You know, and on some level, I mean, I get it. Like, I don't mean to be too cynical or snide here, but to me, it reveals. I mean, it was well intentioned. I get it, but the truth is that there's the disconnect right there. You know, I mean, it's a blind spot, right? And so, what I had this idea that one thing, a very powerful experience for people is sort of cathartic performance. You know, the sort of like you sort of express yourself before your community. And it was that was incorporated into a lot of ceremonies that Native American tribes use to bring warriors back into the community or combat veterans from modern wars back onto the reservation into the community. It's still going on. And a common component of it is that basically the veteran or the warrior recounts their exploits on the battlefield in front of the community, in front of the people that they did those things for, right? And so what it does is it connects, it makes the experience that happened on the battlefield part of the community, the fabric of community, and it makes the community part of what happened on the battlefield. It blends those two things as they should be. And I was in Oklahoma a few months ago, and this woman came up to me, and she was of the Kiowa Nation, and she was a vet. And she said, you know, before I went to Iraq, she said, my whole community, in full traditional regalia, sort of drummed her out of town. And when she came back, they did the same thing. And she said, I don't have PTSD, I'm fine. Because she said, I deployed with my, spiritually speaking, psychologically speaking, she deployed with her entire community. So sort of long preamble for what my idea is, you know, we're not going to do sweat lodges and, you know, whatever. I get it. Like, we're not, we just logistically can't do some of those things. But every city, every town in this country has a town hall. It's the city hall. It's the civic center of every community in this country. And on Veterans Day, it's not open for business. There's no business being conducted. So it's available to be used if you can get someone to unlock the door and turn on the PA system. And the idea that I had was that you basically invite veterans of all wars to stand up, and for 10 minutes at a time, all you get is 10 minutes, that's enough, and for 10 minutes to describe what the war felt like and to the community. And that means the community has to show up. Like, you got to show up. If you support the troops, I don't care if you're against the war or not, it doesn't matter. But if you support the troops, and supporting the troops, the extension of that is, I support my country. Like, I'm part of this country, right? And you show up and you just listen. And this isn't a debate about the merits of the war. This isn't a peace protest. This isn't a patriotic thing. This isn't anything. It just allows veterans to say what it was like to be at D-Day or in Vietnam. Some people are going to be really proud of their service. And some vets are going to say, I missed the war. I wish I was back there. Frankly, they're going to say that, some version of that. Some vets are going to be really angry and will make everyone uncomfortable because they're so angry. And I've seen that happen. And some vets are going to be crying too hard to talk at all. And everyone's going to be heartbroken. But that's all of that's war, right? If we're going to go to war, our young men and women are going to have all of those feelings. And if we don't assemble to let them, to let those feelings out, they're stuck with those feelings. And they're having those feelings because we asked them to. But if you start to do that, and if you do that in every town in this country, not only will veterans benefit, I sincerely think, we've done it, I've seen them benefit by that ceremony. Not only will they benefit, but it will begin to cohere the country a bit. It will begin to feel like we're a unified society, which we desperately need. And the healthier this country is in that sense, the easier it's going to be for veterans. The easier it's going to be for veterans to come home. But more to the point, the more appealing it's going to be for them to come home.
Is it easy to disconnect from the war because we have a desensitivity to violence, that this, we are disengaged from our political process in many ways, so it was somebody else's decision to go to war, and those guys are over there doing that job, and I've got my phone here, and I'm just going to read what I want. Then they're going to come back, and they're just... Are we so disengaged from war itself that a conversation like that doesn't really happen very often? That people wouldn't stand up and speak the truth about what they experienced to a public forum?
Well, yeah, I mean, there isn't much ceremonial time and space in this society, right? So, yeah, that doesn't happen because it's not a recognized process. Like, we just don't do it. And what I would say is that, I mean, just to go back to what I said before, we're disconnected from everything. I mean, yeah, we're disconnected from war. We're also disconnected from oil, the production of oil. We're also disconnected from the cutting down of trees and the farming of food. We're disconnected from everything. And a lot of that stuff costs a lot of lives. Like, in 2014, there are some sort of perennial leaders in, you know, the list of dangerous jobs that kills the most people every year. You know, it's logging, commercial fishing, oil. I mean, farming, interestingly. I mean, there's sort of, like, every year it's sort of mostly the same industries. And in 2014, just to pick a year out of a hat, around 5,000 people were killed in workplace accidents in these dangerous jobs, keeping this nation going, which is almost the casualty count of both of Iraq and Afghanistan combined for the entirety of those wars, just in one year, right? We are not connected to that. And so, yeah, do we need to connect to violence and more if we're going to wage war? Yeah, absolutely. But that's just the beginning. I mean, really, it's just the beginning of what we need to connect to run an ethical and connected society.
Do we do veterans a disservice by thanking them for their service without truly engaging in their experience with them?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of situations where you meet someone briefly, like on the bus, and there really isn't the chance to engage fully in an experience that lasted 15 months and contains enormously complex emotions. So I don't think it's realistic in the moments of a person's day to connect like that. I can't imagine that we could do it in any other context.
But even as a group.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the point. That would, for me, would be the point of a ceremony on Veterans Day, is to make a point of doing that once a year as a group. I don't. It's very hard to understand other people's experiences, and it's not a realistic expectation. I will never know what it's like to give birth. You know, it's just not happening. And I'm never going to know what it's like to be a soldier either. But that doesn't mean that we can't have enormous empathy for those experiences, but we're not going to understand them all. When you say thank you for your service, I think it's well-intentioned. I think often civilian people say that because they don't know what else to say, and they feel like they should say something. I think we should be forgiving for the, you know, in a sense, like it feels awkward and shallow, but it's also well-meaning. So I don't know quite how to judge it. I think veterans are starting to bridle that a little bit. One of the downsides of saying it, I mean, in Israel, they don't say thank you for your service because everyone serves. You know, it would be like saying thank you for paying your taxes in this country. I mean, it's like, yeah, right, the country wouldn't exist without it, but everyone's doing it. It's just a given, right? And, you know, I think one thing that could be enormously healthy for this country is to have mandatory national service. I think it's immoral to put a gun in someone's hand who doesn't want to fight. But I think mandatory national service with a military option, I think, would be an incredibly healthy thing for this country. My father once pointed out to me, I was debating the sort of morality, this is right post-Vietnam, I was debating the morality of signing my Selective Service card. And 18-year-old boys still get in the mail a card from their government that says, we want to know where you live in case we need to come find you to put a gun in your hand to fight a war. Girls don't get that. Boys do. And I got mine at 18, and the draft was over with, right? It was 1980. I was the first year of young men who got this card. And so my father, like, what is this? I grew up in New England. My parents were like very committed pacifists. Everyone I knew was against the Vietnam War, and I just had no idea what this thing was. I said, I'm not signing this. And he said, yeah, you are. He said, look, the United States saved the world in World War II. There's thousands of American soldiers buried in France. My father grew up in Europe. He grew up in France. He said, thousands of American soldiers buried in France. They saved the world, and you don't owe your country nothing. And you may owe it your life. And if the war that you're called to fight is an immoral war in your estimation, then you have just as much obligation to protest it and not fight it as you do to fight a moral war. It's an equal obligation to your country, but you're going to sign that card. And I did. And when he put it that way, I was suddenly like tremendously proud to be part of this like amazing collective experiment. And that is a little bit of that feeling that I think might be obtained by everybody, boys and girls both, if national service were required.
You had, you talk a little bit about an experience you had with a panic attack in the subway when you had returned from a trip. Do you miss covering war?
Yeah, I do. I do. I don't cover combat anymore. But I both miss it, and I'm glad I don't cover it anymore. I'm sure if you all think about things in your past, you can come up with things like that that you're glad you don't do anymore. But boy, was it like meaningful. I was covering war starting in the early '90s, and I was in Afghanistan in the fall of 2000. So it was a year before 9/11. You know, that was back when the Taliban had an air force. I mean, they had MiGs. You know, they had tanks. They had all that stuff. And I was with the Northern Alliance, and we really got pounded a few times. And I came home pretty deranged, actually. But I didn't know what PTSD was because the country wasn't at war, and no one was talking about it. I live in New York City, and I went down into the subway, and out of the blue, I just had this massive panic attack. It was rush hour, so it was a little, you know, it was a lot of people, whatever. But you know, everything I was looking at was a threat. Like the trains were going too fast, where somehow we're going to like jump the rail and like hit me. And the crowds were going to turn on me and beat me to death. The lights were too bright. I mean, everything I was looking at was a mortal threat. And I intellectually knew that it wasn't, but my body was reacting as if it was. And I was way more scared in that subway station than I'd ever been in Afghanistan. And I just sprinted out of there. And I kept having panic attacks whenever I was in a small space where there were too many people and I didn't have sort of control over my circumstances. I would just panic. And it happened in a ski gondola too, really badly. And and then much later I found, I just thought I was going crazy. I mean, really, I thought I was going crazy. And it slowly went away because for most people, PTSD, unless you're continually re-traumatized, PTSD subsides, and it did for me.
What do you miss about it? Is it an adrenaline? Is it your sense of purpose?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you feel like as a journalist, you know, reporting on the war in Bosnia, I was in Sierra Leone during the Civil War, I was in Liberia. You're watching history. You're reporting on events that have enormous consequences for people, for humanity, for the country, for the world. And it feels it's like an enormous honor and privilege to be doing that. And there was obviously also, you know, it's combat is a super intense thing, and you get, you know, among other things, you get a kind of cocktail of endorphins and adrenaline that is like pretty, you know, can be pretty intoxicating. But to say it's like an adrenaline addiction would be to trivialize it. Is much more, the calling to be a journalist in war zones is much more profound than that.
And you have your tribe of war journalists.
Yeah, there's an affiliation for sure. Tribe is technically, I mean, the way I discuss it, it's people you live with that you share resources with and that you would help defend with your life. That's your tribe. And, you know, in a transitory way, war by war, messed up place by messed up place, you can feel that with journalists at times, for sure.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
That's it for this podcast of Speakers Forum. Again, you can hear the full version on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Thanks again to Bree Ripley for our recording. Tune in again soon for more from Speakers Forum.